As Israel ponders its response to Iran, as allies urge restraint, as battles targeting Tehran proxies rage in Lebanon, let's begin with a simple fact of geography. Iran and Israel do not share a common border. Since October the 8th, Tehran's been touting a so-called axis of resistance, what Israelis brand as a ring of fire, with Iranian-backed militants in Lebanon, in Gaza, Yemen, Syria, to which the United States would probably add Iraq. Are the past 2 weeks of military successes for Israel a short run that restores an aura of might, or a more profound blow that could deal a severe setback for a long time to these non-state actors and upend the region's balance in ways unseen since the 1979 Iranian Revolution? One can look at Middle East rivalries and alliances through the prism of Israel's relations with its neighbors, but also through the up-and-down Sunni-Shia divide. In the middle are the likes of Jordan, whose military shot down Iranian missiles Tuesday night. Its own population sees no good outcome in the current spike in tension. With the U.S. and Europe ineffective in stopping the spiral the past 12 months, is there any bold initiative that can turn the current nightmare, well, into a positive dynamic? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at the Middle East's domino effect, and joining us from Athens, she's a peace negotiator. Nomi Bar-Yaakov is also a fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Francois.
From Riyadh, commentator Salman Al-Ansari. Good to see you.
Merci beaucoup, Francois. It's so good to be back with you.
Laurence Louer is associate professor at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po Série, the research wing of Sciences Po. Your books include Sunnis and Shia, A Political History. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We shall be joined shortly by Nadim Houri, executive director of the Arab Reform Initiative. By the way, reminder, you can always listen back, and subscribe to the podcast version of the France 24 debate. To each day, a further sign of a long campaign brewing in Lebanon. For the first time, the army there no longer just Hezbollah militants exchanging fire with Israeli forces. Israel, which continues to hit Hezbollah targets in densely populated parts of Beirut. Eliza Herbert has more.
Black smoke blanketed Beirut on Thursday afternoon as multiple Israeli strikes hit the Lebanese capital, following a night of intense and deadly bombardments. Here, an apartment building sits gutted. Reportedly home to Hezbollah's media office, it had been evacuated before it was obliterated. In the heart of the city, a strike on the Hezbollah-linked Islamic Health Organization left multiple dead and others injured. Israel says it is targeting Hezbollah militants. This man disagrees.
There were already threats against health institutions, and indeed they hit the health institution. This is not a holy war, this is a war against civilians. They want the submission of Lebanon. If they can, they want to destroy the entire infrastructure of Lebanon until Lebanon submits.
According to the Lebanese health minister, Israeli attacks have killed nearly 2,000 people since last October, including 127 children and 97 emergency workers, a number that has rapidly climbed in recent days.
It's unfair to target not only unarmed people, but also others trying to pull out injured people. I reiterate that the international laws are clear in protecting those paramedics. Who gave Israel the right to be the judge and the executioner at the same time?
Meanwhile, on the southern border, fighting continued, and the Lebanese army became involved for the first time, returning fire on Israeli forces after they killed one of its soldiers in a strike that hit his convoy that was accompanying the Lebanese Red Cross. Israel's Defense Force said on Thursday that it had struck around 200 Hezbollah targets across Lebanon. It also issued the evacuation of residents in more than 20 Lebanese towns and villages, saying that Hezbollah's activities forced the IDF to act against it forcefully, and those who move south will be at risk.
Nomi Bar-Yaakov, we see in that report civilians caught in the middle of all of this. For ordinary Israelis who are watching the events unfold right now, Do they see this as a war against Hezbollah, a war against Iran, a war against Lebanon?
No, definitely not a war against Lebanon. I mean, the Lebanese may view it like that, given there are Lebanese civilians that have been killed in the war, and quite a large number. But in Israel, it's viewed very much so as a war against Hezbollah. But of course, there is much fear that the government stated that they're going in surgically and for a very short period of time. But given the history of Israeli incursions turned into invasions of Lebanon, the risk is high, and I think many Israelis are very anxious about where this is actually going, whether the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu really means in and out. It doesn't look that way from the way it's going. So the Israelis are divided. I think they're very much divided. Some would support this and some would be dead against this incursion, including the bombing of the center of Beirut today.
The bombing in the center of Beirut. Laurence Louer, this is... there are blurred lines here because Hezbollah is a non-state actor. In fact, it's a headline, the fact that Israeli forces exchange fire with the Lebanese National Army this Thursday for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. But Hezbollah has been very often described as a state within a state in Lebanon. So it's not just an armed group. It's also a political party. It has MPs in the parliament. It has participated in the Lebanese government. It runs a whole network of charities, hospitals, and social services. So here is also the ambiguity. Where is the Lebanese state? Where is Hezbollah? As you said, boundaries are very much blurred between the two.
The lines are blurred between the two. Paris traffic could not keep him away. Nadim Houri of the Arab Reform Initiative, thanks for being with us here.
Thank you for having me.
In the France 24 debate. We were just talking about the events of the past 24 hour. Naomi Bar-Yaakov saying how Israel says in and out, but she fears that's not what it's looking like right now.
Well, when we look at the images there are two indicators that actually Israel's ambition goes a lot more than what they're saying. Just the sheer number of tanks and machinery on the Israeli side of the border, but also the evacuation orders, quote unquote, that Israel has been issuing for villages in Lebanon, even north of the Litani, north of Tyr. That is indicative.
This Thursday, that included the town of Nabatieh, which is north of the Litani River.
Not just Nabatieh, a number of towns that are really in the interior of Tyr. And if this is Israel's ambition, that would indicate a much broader plan to invade.
A much broader plan to invade. Salman al-Ansari, the last 12 months, we've been looking mostly at one front, the Gaza Strip, and now it's two fronts. Will this continue how far do you see the escalation going?
Yeah, thank you again, Francois. Yeah, it's very concerning, to be honest. And I think the Middle East is going into a very dangerous period where we have to have cool-headed people from the international community to put the flame down. And with regards to the Saudi view of the whole thing, I'm an independent political analyst. I have to give this disclaimer, but I think Saudi Arabia doesn't have a horse at the race between Israel and Iran. I think the kingdom is in a different racetrack, which is working to achieve an independent state for the Palestinians through its active diplomatic efforts.
But Saudi Arabia is a country that's had a lot of influence in Lebanon and has been a patron at times for some of the political actors there. What's it doing in Lebanon right now?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, Saudi Arabia for the last couple of years has been fed up with disagreements within the political elites, etc., in Lebanon. There's no doubt about that. And we've pushed the Lebanese government and people to find a way through which they can get out of this dilemma. And we know that it's not a secret that Saudi Arabia has a very strong stance against non-state actors. The idea and the notion of having a country within a country is not something that we prefer to deal with, specifically when this militia is actually working tirelessly to jeopardize the security of Saudi Arabia and the region. But that doesn't mean in any way whatsoever that we accept the indiscriminate attack by the IDF and Israel against civilians. We are speaking of more than 2,000 people have died just in a few days, and 10% of them, around 170 children among them. So we are speaking of a catastrophe that maybe the far-right government of Israel wants to replicate the Gaza genocide in Lebanon, which is something that is very heartbreaking for all the people in the region and for all humanity. So we would love to see the world to be going back to its senses and to put Israel into account and to not allow them to act with complete impunity. And the same thing, actually, the Prince Faisal bin Farhan, the Foreign Affairs Minister of Saudi Arabia, has published an op-ed at the Financial Times 2 days ago, and he said the true obstacles of peace are not the Palestinians and Israelis, but rather the radicals and warmongers. So we want that to stop, because this is not going to go well for the region and for the whole world.
Yeah, we'll come back to those diplomatic efforts. But Nadim Houri, we've been saying it basically every night on this set for the last 2 weeks. U.S. right now, its voice is not very loud ahead of a presidential election. France's mediation efforts that were talked up a little bit during UN week last week, they've been ineffective. Your thoughts on outside players when it comes to Lebanon, in particular the likes of Saudi Arabia?
Look, no, I think the main outside player is obviously the U.S., and the main role is what can the U.S. do vis-a-vis Israel? And I think here we have had Team Biden that has actually been sleepwalking, in my view, and it's been an utter failure on two levels. On the one hand, they say a lot of things. We're trying to rein them in. We want to see peace and so forth. But this is a rough region. Everyone knows when the U.S., supposedly the sole superpower, speaks, you're supposed to leverage your what you're saying. And they say that, and then sometimes a few minutes later, a day later, Netanyahu basically undermining them completely, you know, making Biden look like a fool in the region. And that's not a good look for someone in the Middle East. And then what do they do after that? The U.S. then writes a check, $9 billion. Sends more weapons, and so forth. So I think the U.S. has been completely, I would say, you know, unstrategic, sleepwalking, supporting. Very hard for me to understand what's really driving it. And lately, after the, and you know, based on the leaks that we saw in Politico and others, after the assassination of Nasrallah, some of that old fiber that they had after 2003, that some people in the U.S. administration think they can remodel the Middle East just with a few airstrikes, you know, albeit very impressive, high tech and so forth, and it would work out well. Some of these voices, you know, I saw some of those old people that were in 2003 back on TV saying this is our chance to redo the region, very expansive goals, where we know how the story ends. We've seen it so many times. We've seen it in 2003 in Lebanon. We've seen it after Israel's invasion in 1982. We saw it in between Israel and Hezbollah in 2006. So who is the adult in the room today? Clearly no one on the international scene. I actually think the Arab proposition on the table is actually a serious proposition. If the Israeli government is willing to cash their chips in, you know, they came out of a winning two rounds right now. Can they cash out, get a decent deal? But that would mean they would have to accept, I think, two things. One, a Palestinian state, some form of Palestinian state. And two, they will have to find some way to coexist in a new Middle East with the Iranians. We actually saw Saudi Arabia is making peace with Iran. They are trying to integrate Iran into their calculation. We saw Iran make deals with the UAE. We saw the rapprochement that China had supervised, obviously with the Oman mediation between the Saudis and the Iranians. Can Israel do it? The current government doesn't seem like it, because if you hear what they're saying, they think they're going to go for Beirut and then go for Tehran, and they're going to try to impose it. And I think they're about to make a massive mistake. The problem is, who will pay the price? It's probably people in Lebanon, in Palestine, perhaps even as well in Jordan.
Naomi Bar-Yaakov, the former prime minister, Naftali Bennett, he's in opposition. And he was tweeting how there's a chance for Israel to remake the Middle East like it hasn't been in half a century. I'm paraphrasing slightly. I don't have the quote in front of me. And he's in the opposition. It doesn't sound like Israel's about to cash in its chips, as Nadim would say.
No, at the moment, Naftali Bennett isn't even on the opposition in the sense that he isn't a member of the Knesset yet. He's just going to run for office, and he's very likely to, you know, last time he ended up as prime minister, even though his party only got six votes, if I'm not mistaken. So they're very, you know, he's a very powerful character behind the scenes. And actually, while he was prime minister, he ordered to attack Iran directly, and then he boasted about it in an op-ed he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, saying that, you know, given that Iran is using all its long arms, basically substates, the proxies, one has to hit Iran itself. So clearly he's of that view, and Netanyahu is of that view, and everybody in his extreme government is. So I fully agree with Nadim Houri that, and also with the Saudi commentator, I mean, the plan is there. There is a very, very serious plan on the table. 57 Arab states, international organizations, you know, the General Assembly was used. They offered both His Royal Highness, the Foreign Minister of Saudi Arabia, and the Foreign Minister of Jordan. They both stood on the podium and said, look, we're willing to offer you normalization, peace, you as Israel. All you need to do is recognize that a Palestinian state and help us realize it. And clearly that is that is a possibility. And the vision of the Israeli government at present is on a different planet.
Is there a scenario under which Benjamin Netanyahu accepts the idea of a two-state solution?
If somebody will bail him out, I mean, if he will be able to have a coalition, if the opposition members will join the coalition and the current extreme elements in his coalition would drop out. But he won't do it unless he stays in office as prime minister, given that he's going to be blamed for the 7th October 2023 massacre's slaughter. And there's a massive corruption trial that is on hold because of the war. But the only way that he would allow for any diplomatic efforts to materialize and not just be a game is if he could stay in office.
Well, Laurence Louaire, you listened to my introduction, right? I was asking, is this one of those moments, because we're talking about one of these moments where perhaps the Middle East is on the cusp of some kind of great change? Is it?
I'm not sure. It's more like it's something else. What will change? Israel is dominant. Israel has the technology, the military means to impose itself.
It didn't seem dominant last October 7th.
No, but it was just a parenthesis. Look at what is happening now. No state in the region has the military means to win a war against Israel. Iran is weakened. Iran has been humiliated, as it has been said. And what is quite interesting also is that Iran is restraining itself trying to send messages to the U.S. in particular that we don't want to destabilize the region. We would like to go back to the negotiations over the nuclear program. So it's a never-ending process. It's something that we've seen already after the regime change in Iraq in 2003. And so regularly we see the Iranians trying to negotiate something. As long as nobody is willing to enter into a real bargain, negotiate something in exchange in particular for
maintaining the status quo.
Yeah. So now that we see is quite of violent status quo somehow.
And a status quo that depends on allies and proxies. And what's an interesting point is, talk about Hezbollah. It's got plenty of enemies inside Lebanon. Last week's killing, though, of Hassan Nasrallah sparked a common sense of foreboding rightfully so, since right now we've seen that the campaign by Israel is stepping up. Hezbollah, which grew into an international movement a decade ago, this was during the civil war in neighboring Syria. Our team in Turkey received images from the only rebel province left in Syria, Idlib, in the northwest. It's a story read by Melvin Ingleby.
In Idlib, for once, it's time to rejoice. People are celebrating Israel's attacks on Hezbollah and the death of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah. They hand out sweets, congratulate each other, and follow every bit of news coming out of Lebanon.
We are overjoyed that the leader of Hezbollah was assassinated by the Zionist state. Obviously, we do not support Israel, but we are very happy that one of the oppressors that participated in the massacre of our Syrian brothers and other people in the region was taken out.
This destruction is partly the work of Hezbollah. Throughout the war in Syria, the Shia Lebanese movement has fought alongside the Assad regime. To this day, it is active in regime positions just outside the province of Idlib and regularly attacks this rebel stronghold.
The presence of Hezbollah since the start of the Syrian revolution is no secret to anyone. We know they were here in large numbers during the campaign in western Aleppo, in the eastern province of Idlib, along the coast. It's also well known that Hezbollah fighters took part in recent military campaigns of the regime against the Syrian people.
Over half of Idlib's population of around 4 million has been displaced by the war. This family in the Altar camp lost their home in an attack by Hezbollah. To them, today's news comes as a relief.
Before the revolution, we supported Hezbollah, but they betrayed us. They forced us to leave our homes, they stole our belongings, destroyed our schools and villages. Today we are seeing what Israel is doing to Hezbollah. They are being eliminated and it's bringing us joy. It's warming the hearts of the young and the old.
But the attacks keep coming. These images were sent to us by residents of Kafria a few days ago. Local authorities say the regime strikes were fired from Hezbollah positions in retaliation for recent celebrations. According to the Syrian civil defense, this latest attack has left 5 people dead, including children.
Nadim Houri, we forgot about the civil war in Lebanon, in Syria, excuse me. Your reaction to that report, who says before the revolution we supported Hezbollah?
You know, I worked for a very long time. I continued to work on Syria, so I'm very familiar with these feelings. And I think it's a testament as well to where the region is today. People have lost so much hope that their only joy they get is when their enemy is getting hurt. And it's the same between Lebanese and Israelis, you know, it's really a moment right now where people's joy, the little they can get, is basically when they see an enemy getting hurt by someone else. But I just want to go back on two things. Yes, it's true. You know, in 2006, Israel had underestimated Hezbollah, and they paid a price for it. This time around, Hezbollah underestimated Israel, and they paid a big price for it.
But did they also overreach when it came to Syria?
We'll get back to that in a second. But I actually think here there's a danger. There's a danger right now that Israel overestimates its capacity. Hezbollah's history is a history of resilience. Every single secretary general of Hezbollah has been killed, assassinated. And every time they sort of come out with another one and they end up going on. The last 2 days, in terms of the ground fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, if I'm an IDF commander, and I hope never to be, that would not be something they're looking forward to. Their dominance that they have shown in terms of intel, in terms of airstrikes, is not translating into Hezbollah collapsing at a very micro level, ground level. So that would worry. The other scenario that I think also underestimating Iran, after the U.S. invasion in 2003, everyone thought Iran was completely cornered, right? The U.S. was actually in Iraq. The U.S. was actually in Afghanistan. Iraq was completely isolated. This was Pax Americana. Iran played a long game. And today, 20 years later, it's the Americans leaving Baghdad. And actually, Iran treats with Iraq as if it was a province of Tehran. So the problem in the region is that there's a long game and everyone has a tendency to, whenever they're winning, to overstep it. And I think Hezbollah did overstep it. And I think in most decent obituaries of Hassan Nasrallah, there is the Hassan Nasrallah for many Lebanese of 2000 and 2006. And actually for the entire region, you know, We like it or we not like it. I would have preferred that the Lebanese state liberate Lebanon, but the Lebanese state failed to do so, and it was actually Hezbollah that pushed the Israelis out, that made it in their calculus to leave. He had a huge credit with Lebanese, even secular Lebanese who actually dislike all their ideals. In 2006, he proved he was effective, and he gained the respect, obviously, of his followers and of segments of the Lebanese population. Starting in 2008, he turned his guns on parts of Lebanon. There were the assassinations. There was May 2008 when they took over Beirut. And then, obviously, there was for the region when Hezbollah got involved to save his buddy Bashar al-Assad, the butcher in Damascus. They lost a lot. That doesn't mean that this will translate into empathy, like the people in your interview saying, towards Israel. You know, I think the big tragedy right now for the region, particularly for the Arabs of the region, is they're being given two choices. Either you go with the Israel-US axis, or you go with the Iran axis. And most people actually do not want to be in either axis. It hasn't served them well. They don't see themselves. And I think what we need to do is a rebuild a regional order that takes into account the interests of the states in between what used to become the flyover countries of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and so forth. And I think friends in the Gulf, if they can play a role, because for a while, particularly under UAE leadership, they went for it bilaterally. You know, we'll do the deals. Tel Aviv and Dubai will prosper. To hell with the other ones. I think they're realizing right now that there needs to be a regional deal. And I am hopeful if we see the Gulf more engaged, strategic, but that will require them to be able to exert some pressure on the Americans and maybe for Europe to wake up.
Yeah, 12 months of reducing Gaza to rubble, raising calls to review the normalization of ties with Israel in places like Morocco, Bahrain. You mentioned flyover countries. Jordan is literally one. Its military, along with the American station, they're intercepting Iranian missiles directed at Israel on Tuesday evening. Salman al-Ansari, public opinion in Jordan, it's conflicted, to say the least. We've been speaking to a lot of people the last 48 hours there, and they wish they didn't have a stake in this fight, but they do.
Absolutely. It's very sad, like what's going on. And definitely what we want to see is de-escalation right now, because what we are seeing from the Israeli part and also from the Iranian part is escalate to escalate, not escalate to de-escalate, no, escalate to escalate without an ending, without an end game. So that's actually very problematic. But we have to put some optimism here. There are things that have been achieved through the Muslim and Arab world, managed and led by Saudi Arabia and its partners. They have managed to accomplish three major successes. First, breaking the Israeli siege by providing humanitarian assistance to Palestinian civilians. Second, securing recognition of Palestine from around six European countries, such as Spain, Ireland, Norway, Latvia, etc. And third, facilitating a seat for Palestine at the United Nations. Some people might see this as symbolic, but not at all. They are actually very meaningful.
Well, let's talk, Salman, let's talk about what's happening just in the last few days, because you alluded to earlier. There's been, in the last 24 hours, a special session of the Gulf Cooperation Council in Doha. It included a sidelines meeting between the Saudi foreign minister, Faisal bin Farhan, and the new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian. Our reporter in Tehran saying that the Iranians have brought a message that they're ready to use what they call unconventional means to hit back at Israel. And it's believed by many that that includes, you know, using those proxies, the so-called axis of resistance, should and when Israel strikes back now. So what can the Saudis do?
Yeah, from my point of view, I think, as you know, that there is a normalization with Iran that is brokered by China. So I think it's not something to be expected to see the Iranian regime to take any, crazy step against the Saudi security or the GCC security at a whole. But at the same time, as they say, when we get to a position where we have an all-out war, then every calculation might be different. So definitely these discussions are very important to see how we can avoid any escalation beyond the areas where the conflicts are, and also to try our best to de-escalate the situation. It's not an easy task. We see how the legal umbrella and the political umbrella that the U.S. has provided to Israel is very unfortunate, and we'd love for our American friends to take steps to pressure Israel, because they have enough leverage on them, but they are not, I don't know, for some reason they are not able to use them, but they can. But with regards to the situation, I think the GCC countries, as your guest has mentioned, that and many Arab countries, they do not want to take or to bet on any of these. And to be fair and to be to have some kind of like an equal condemnation, I would say theocracy versus ethnocracy. Israel ethnocracy, Iran theocracy. So definitely these two countries have been wreaking havoc in the region by their practices. Israel has been doing so through their continuous occupation and their dehumanization of the Palestinians. And Iran, on the other hand, has no regard for international law, just like Israel, and they have used militants and militias all across the Middle East. So these two countries need to take lessons out of this conflict and to get back to their senses, because we cannot entertain the idea of having an all-out war in the Middle East.
Be able to mediate effectively, you need to have some leverage. We've talked about the ineffectiveness of the United States, but let's turn back the clock a second, look into history for a second. You don't need concessions to plan for war. You do to make peace. And we're talking in the week that Jimmy Carter has celebrated his 100th birthday, the former U.S. president, a living reminder of the Camp David Accords brokered between Egypt and Israel. Egypt, whose then-president Anwar Sadat made the bold move of traveling to Israel in 1977, just 4 years after the Yom Kippur War. Salman Ansari, what if the Saudi crown prince went to Israel, stood next to Benjamin Netanyahu and said, I'll make a deal with you, you recognize Palestine. Wouldn't that be the bold move everyone's waiting for?
I don't think it's... it's just an optic kind of hypothesis. What we are trying to
that's
have is to
that's
have
what Anwar Sadat did. I mean, that deal was not signed yet when he went to Israel.
Yeah, and I think it's was a different case. Israel and Egypt, they had their own wars, etc., and they had their own problems with lands, etc. So they had this step that was historic. But with regard to the crown prince, absolutely, he will be happy to visit any country he normalizes relation with. So the ball is in the court of the Israeli camp. Do they want to normalize relations, not only with Saudi Arabia, but with more than 57 countries in the world? So we are speaking of almost one third of the global South. So imagine the trade volume. Imagine the opportunities that will happen. Imagine
right, but what's the bold move that Saudi? What's the bold move that Saudi Arabia can make? What can it do right now?
It has been asking for the same thing forever. We are not asking for too much. We are asking to have the United Nations Security Council's resolutions to be applied. Nothing new. All what we want is to have the Palestinians to have their own dignity, to not to be considered as second and third class citizens. This is very a stigma in the international community to have this to be seen live 24/7, seeing this ethnocracy and this kind of hatred that has been actually provided by some factions of the Israeli community. I'm not giving excuses, or I'm not actually saying that the Palestinians didn't have their own share part. The same thing goes with everyone. Nobody is perfect, but the Palestinians have been asking for the minimum, which is a state of their own. And
right.
It has been recognized by the United Nations, and things will develop, and the whole Arab and Muslim world will actually guarantee this. So,
all right, let me bring in Nomi Bar Yaakov on this. Nomi Bar Yaakov, you're a peace negotiator is one of your remits here. So, what is the bold move that's realistic, possible, doable right now?
I think a delegation from a number of Gulf countries, even. there were statements made in the UN, and the UN isn't, from an Israeli point of view, certainly not from the government's point of view, they have actually made Antonio Guterres a persona non grata. So there's also, there are problems, and we need to look at everything through a different lens. We need to look at it through what is going to make a difference to the Israelis, and it's not statements. So, for example, when Prince Turki bin Faisal gave an interview to the leading Israeli television channel, that was a massive sea change. And the Israeli media is very powerful. It's operating as a war, has been operating, still is operating as a 24/7 media sort of during war. They are living and breathing their trauma. They're blind to the trauma of the other. They're hardly reporting on any of the civilian casualties and the catastrophic situation in Gaza, soon to be in Lebanon, and who knows about Iran. So it's absolutely urgent. I would urge Arab leaders. I think the op-ed that the Saudi foreign minister wrote in the Financial Times is fantastic, but no one in Israel reads the Financial Times, and one needs to address the Israeli public directly. And so it's through me, making a visit to Israel and explaining. All you need to do is recognize a Palestinian state. The problem is that Israelis at the moment, and that has I mean all Israelis at the moment, cannot see how a Palestinian state is going to make Israel more secure. They don't really believe that diplomatic relations with 57 Islamic and Arab states is going to make them more secure. They think it's just a ploy, and they think it's a trick. So it requires serious thinking about what kind of security guarantees will be made in this very serious and wonderful diplomatic effort, both to Israel and Palestine. So basically, once the security guarantees are sorted, and Israel is kind of seeking an Article 5 type, Article 5 of NATO, so Israel's attacked, NATO will protect it, that sort of thing. And I'm not suggesting it has to be NATO. There can be new alliances. But there is no trust at the moment. And there's no time to build trust. There needs to be a declaration, and there need to be moves, starting with a ceasefire in Gaza, ceasefire in Lebanon, and very fast track moving towards a Palestinian state in order to avert a disaster. So yes, I agree, Francois. This requires a bold move from a number of Arab leaders in order to reach out to the Israeli people. Not necessarily to the Israeli prime minister and his messianic extreme government, but to the Israeli people. And one way of doing it is through the media.
All right, so reach out directly to the other side. Laurence Louer, we've been talking about, mostly in this show, there's two prisms that we've been talking about. There's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict spillover effect. There's the Israel-Iran direct confrontation, and we're waiting for the other shoe to drop with Israel's response to those missiles that were fired on Tuesday. How about that balance? Because it's kind of the subtext of the report we saw out of Syria earlier, that balance between the Sunni world and the Shia world. Is that being impacted by all of this, or does the status quo remain?
I don't think the Sunni-Shia issue, is really an issue behind what is happening.
But can it be impacted by what's happening?
Not really. Because it's not about that. When we look at Iran's proxies, so-called proxies, non-state actors, allies, we see Hezbollah, yes, it's a Shia Islamic movement, but Hamas is not at all. It's fully Sunni. The Houthi in Yemen are not Shia, strictly speaking. So it's rather an alliance, or rather loose alliance of groups which have common interest, a common understanding also about how the Middle East should look like without Israel, without Western influence. And each of these groups also, I think it's important to say, has its own agency, its own interest, agenda, objectives, and they do not necessarily correspond, for example.
You heard Nadim Houri say that in the past, leadership of Hezbollah has been hit before and risen from the ashes. Are all these non-state actors here to stay no matter what? Or is their star power fine? It's just they've had a couple of bad weeks?
I think so, because they are not mere Iranian puppets. They existed before before Iran. I mean, Hezbollah did not exist before Iran, but it's been built on the various Shia Islamic movements that existed in Lebanon since the 60s. So it's not, strictly speaking, an Iranian puppet. It's not dependent on Iran. It's not doing everything Iran wants or would want. It's deeply embedded, Hezbollah, into the Shia Lebanese community. As I said earlier, I mean, it has institutions, it has a lot of political influence. And look at the Houthi in Yemen, same thing. I mean, they are deeply embedded in the Yemeni society. They've been there for several decades, and they are powerful. They control much of the Yemeni territory. So it's fate. It's not directly linked, I mean, if existentially speaking, to what is happening currently. Yes, Hezbollah has been weakened, but it has the capacity to reshape itself and to find new leaders, because it's not just an Iranian
so
proxy.
So you're saying effectively that the political fault lines that are born from that period, we saw the clips of the Camp David Accords, of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, those political fault lines are roughly the same today.
Well, yes, they are roughly the same.
Shall they move, Nadine Hoori?
No, I mean, for me, you pose the right question. Can you resolve? There are two essential questions today in the region that we actually have to find a way to resolve them at the same time to move forward, which is the Palestine question, right? And I think, in a way, for a very long time, it was about the Israel question. You know, and for me, Camp David was the answer to the Israel question. The biggest Arab state made peace. Today, those who actually need to be comforted are the Palestinians. They're the ones who are disappearing off the face of the earth. So I think there is the Palestine question, but the problem with the two-state solution and all these frameworks, they dissociated the Palestine question from the regional question. And that's why you try to corner the Palestinians, and it looked like it was going to succeed 2 years ago. It looked like the transactional approach was going to succeed, but guess what? It didn't. So the second equation that needs to be resolved in parallel, which is a question that has been befuddling us since 1979, is the Iran question. Iran is also here to stay, and the Islamic Republic of Iran, in its current phase, is here to stay. So we need to kind of bring these two together, these two equations together, and come up with an arrangement where the Iranians have a stake in making sure whatever is offered to the Palestinians stick. And I would add another layer, and I fully agree with this. These are not just pawns of Iran. Otherwise, Hezbollah would have disappeared a long time ago. Hezbollah is genuinely popular amongst the Shias in Lebanon and even amongst some non-Shias in Lebanon. They have a real base. By some accounts, Hezbollah and it's all his organization is probably the second biggest employer in Lebanon after the Lebanese state. Do we really think they're just going to disappear because we decapitated 15 of their top leaders? Weakened? Definitely. But they're here. We're going to have to live with them. They're part of our society. So where do we go from here? I think we've been probably obsessing too much. By that, I mean international diplomacy about Israel's security concerns. I get that. But you're not going to get to Israel's security concerns if you always look at it from the lens of Israel. At least that's my take. I think that's the lessons for me of what we've seen all the time, because as long as you have people who feel they have lost everything, they will find a way to remind you of their existence, regardless of how powerful you become, regardless of all the means. You know, 7th of October, it was actually Israel saying, we have all the technology, we control Gaza. In all ways, with everything we can, you know, satellite, cameras, algorithms, automatic guns, and so forth. And it wasn't sufficient. Same with 2006. I actually worry that they think now they're very high tech couple of blows to Israel in the last 2 weeks, which I don't want to underestimate. Yeah, to Hezbollah. Major infiltration and so forth. That's going to be enough. I always think of something. Almost 1,500 Lebanese lost an eye or a hand in the beeper attacks and walkie-talkie attacks. Not all of them, by the way, combatants. That's 1,500 families that every day look at a relative and say, I know who did this. How, you know? So my question is, how are you going to comfort these 1,500 people to say, you know what? Don't go and fight Israel. There has to be another place. If we don't find space for these people, for those who've been laissés pour compte, those who've been left on the side of the road for too long in the region, we're not going to be able to move forward. You know, I think the connection Dubai-Tel Aviv showed its limitations. It's great for businessmen making deals on high tech and selling stuff. But you know what? You can't keep everyone down on the end, at the end.
All right, everyone has to be at the table. We'll leave it there. I want to thank you, Nadim Houri. I want to thank as well Laurence Louer, Nomi Bar Yaakov for being with us from Athens, Salman Al Ansari in Riyadh. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.